Hello and welcome to the August edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor and later on I'll be joined by my colleagues at Garden Organic, Chris Collins and Anton Rosenfeld. As we get into August, it's time to reflect on the growing year so far, and what a year it's been. Despite the slugs, the rain and some poor germination here and there, our gardens are slowly but surely catching up. In this episode, I'm joined by Nick Mole, Policy Officer for the Pesticide Action Network, who are working on a petition to ban urban pesticides across the UK. And we'll be answering your questions on courgette flowers and carrot germination. Before we start, I'd just like to thank our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition. Viridian produce a range of award-winning ethical and organic supplements, which include vitamins, minerals, herbal oils and balms. They call themselves the Vitamin Company with an Organic Heart. Their supplements are stocked in over 1,000 specialist health stores across the UK. So to find out more, visit viridian-nutrition.com. That's viridian-nutrition.com. Now, I'm off to join Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Fiona. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you. Now, last month, you were a bit downhearted because of all the rain and all the slugs, and you just decided, right, I'm going to completely start again. And you had a new start to the season, didn't you? I mean, you just cracked on. How's that panned out?
It's actually going really well.
Oh,
I mean,
great.
I was speaking to a lot of the holders, and everybody is a consensus. Everybody's saying what a tough season it's been.
Yes.
It really has been unusual. The toughest I can remember, to be fair. But the good thing about gardening is you can go again, especially if you're sowing from seed, because it's not a massive expense, you know. So I put all my drills in. I put new runner beans in. There's tomato plants, peppers that were I'd already grown, already established, but they weren't growing. Everything's starting to move now. So I'm quite chuffed with my allotment. It looks more like my allotment again. You know, it looked quite sparse and I was getting a lot of problems. So it's on the move. I think I will have a much later harvest this year.
Yeah.
I'm not too bothered about that, to be honest with you. So that will go on. There have been some strange little indicators of been what a weird year it's been. Like my hardy annual seeds, which I always go on about. I let them seed freely. They've only just started to germinate.
See, I think that's fascinating.
So a lot of the calendula. I've got poppies germinating. I've got escalotia germinating. I've got gadisha cornflower. I've got some stuff that came up that's in flower, but very sparse, two or three clumps. But I've got all this new seed that's come up, and I just think that's an indication of how cool the soil's been, how cold the soil's been.
Okay, so what happens with that? Because they've decided to keep the heads down. They've come up. Here we are now in August. So little tiny plants. What are the chances of flowering?
Well, I think they will, but I don't think it'll be this year. I'm going to overwinter them if I can.
Okay.
What's happening is obviously every seed has stratification points where things are okay. It's time to go. It could be extreme like fire, or it could be temperature and sort of thing. So I just think hardy annuals have just sat down. Well, the soils, they realise the soil's not warm enough or something, and that's just inhibited them basically. The test hasn't split, and the seed hasn't germinated. So I think this really interesting. You're seeing this massive flurry of seeds come up, and I let them go past cotyledon into true leaf stage, and I can start to identify them. So I've got a lot of little ones. Some stuff like English pot marigolds are quite big, and they'll flower this year. I've got them around the beans, but on the whole, I'm going to thin them out to the areas I want them in and see if I'm overwintering them for next year.
And these were ones you sowed this year, but they just sat.
These ones I sowed last year.
Oh, you sowed last year.
Yeah. These are the ones that have come off the plant in the autumn.
Yes.
And I just let them go. So you've got, it's quite interesting because obviously when I first sowed them, they were all hybrids, but I only bought them once and then they revert because they're F1s to begin with, then they revert to their original form. It's interesting they've sat and waited this long in the year.
Yeah.
It's these little observations you pick up, you know, that I've even got a lot of baby sunflowers coming up.
Lovely.
I'll thin them out into the little corridor areas that I usually have them in, and I'll see if they can go over the year. Apart from that, August is I like it. It's the chill out month, isn't it, really?
Bit of harvesting going on.
First of all, beans are coming off. I've got a load of potatoes to dig up as well, which I'm looking forward to. Javelin, I've got lots of them. They're a cracking potato. Charlotte as well. I've left them in the ground. They'll all be ready in a while. But so, yeah, there is stuff coming up. I have to say, I'm going back to my habit of a crumble eating.
Yes.
I had a loganberry, apple and rhubarb crumble on Sunday.
Oh, lovely.
And I did it with honey again, and it was straight off the allotment that day, and it was... Oh, Yeah, I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, I love Loganberries. They are amazing, aren't they? Yeah. Have you got much fruit on the allotment?
I haven't got a lot of soft. They take up a lot of room and they cannot. You don't get a big yield for them, I don't think, on my allotment. I'll be different other people's allotments. So I tend to concentrate on other crops, basically. But yeah. I have got a Loganberry, And I've got some blackberry as well. And I think I've got a red currant or two,
I made some red currant jelly last weekend, but that was because somebody very kindly passed on a load of red currants. I can't say that I'd grown them, but they were gorgeous organic red currants, and I've now got 6 jars of jelly, which is that's great. That starts to happen, you know.
Yeah, I think that's one of the best ways to treat soft fruit, because you're not going to eat it all in one go. If you can get it into something like a jam, then you've got it.
I must admit, I'm in pick your own country where I am, you know, around Worcester. There's plenty of farms where you can go and, you know, load up. And last year I really made tons of jam, and it is starting to make me think, actually, I probably don't need to grow raspberries.
Yes, because every year I pick them, you have to weigh that up. Like, if I put peas on the allotment, they never really do seem to do that well. And I get a crop and I'm so excited, and I realise, well, you know, it's 2 handfuls. I can buy a bag for a quid.
Oh, well, I know, I know.
After that taste.
It's the taste.
But I think you do have to, in terms of space and how much time you put in, you need to focus on the crops that you know you're going to enjoy the most.
It's
kind of, you know, I love a courgette, I love a parsnip. So I tend to favour the plants I know I will consume heavily.
Don't just grow something for the sake of ticking a box.
Yes, exactly. It's not space filling. You want to think about what you like to eat. Yeah.
And I was given from the garden here, actually, at Wrighton, I was given last week a great big pot of broad beans and took them home, shelled them. Very disappointing in the sense that an awful lot of the pods just had no beans in them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure that is as a result of the cold.
The temperatures. Yes. It just hasn't been, the heat's not come on, and I just think that's not. They haven't been encouraged to flower as much as this seems to be my guess of it anyway.
Yeah. On the other hand, organic broad bean pods are delicious if you live in my wormery.
Nothing's wasted, isn't it?
Nothing's wasted.
And also, I think the cooler weather, I mean, it looks like I'm going to have some bumper brassicas this year, like my broccoli and my kale.
Really?
I've got a lot of cabbage in, and then, you know, quite nice little plants, and I'm very confident now, come the autumn, I'll get some good crops out of my brassicas.
Yeah, yeah. So, a bit of sowing at all this month?
No, but I am preparing. I am, because obviously September could be, I'll be a very busy month for sowing. All the sort of Asian leafy greens and mustards and stuff like that, mizumas. And also you can look for crops that you want over winter. You'll have a Christmas dinner. I might put some swedes and turnip in, start them off. That may be for stuff for next spring as well. You know, September is an interesting month. I know we're in August now, but your planning starts in August, I think.
It's yes, ticking, exactly.
My head garden's always sort of ahead of itself, so my head's ticking a little bit. But I think that, you know, I love seed sowing. It's my favourite thing about gardening. And I'm going to be cut off from it for 5 months come the end of September, because it's not going to be the time to seed sow. So my favourite thing to do won't be available to me, which always makes spring a bit more exciting, to be fair. But I'm going to have a big seed sow in September. Just to get the last of it in.
Yeah, I like it in September because I also feel like I'm on top of the job by that stage, in the sense that, you know, the season is coming to a close, so it's a lot less pressure. And it's so satisfying. Things are germinating, the sun's still in the sky, you know, and you can have, I don't know, you can just have dreams, can't you? And keep it going. But also you can sow things that then just sit still for the winter.
Yes, you can do, yeah. Mm. A lot of people like to sow their leeks late, or, you know, that kind of stuff, and late into the year. I think there's a lot to be said. Peas in the autumn as well, you can sow, you know, in September.
So if we were going to write a list of what to get, what to assemble from your seed collection in August in order to be ready to do some sowing in September.
Well, definitely on the mizuma, I think. Mustards, or those sort of leafy winter salads, maybe I'll start kicking off. I like to start a lot of those in modules, to be fair, so the palmitoyle will be active. So certainly those, then maybe we look at the brassicas for the spring.
Yes.
Broccoli and kale are quite late as well. There's plenty you can crack on sowing with. You're out of the side of the Mediterranean, the more exotic plants. I mean, even winter squash at a squeeze, maybe, if it are the right conditions. So there's plenty of stuff you can still sow.
Yeah.
Hardy annuals if you haven't already got a load of them germinating.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Get yourself ready.
Even perennials, exinias, stuff like that. There's quite a lot of perennial herbaceous plants you can sow September and sort of as you get towards the end of the season as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so different part of the garden just for a minute. So I have not had a great season, I have to say.
You're alone.
I'm not alone, but I also think I haven't quite put the time in. Partly because it felt like every time I thought I must go into the garden, it was pouring with rain. I'm kind of at the place where I'm thinking all is not lost, because what I was thinking of doing was really planning ahead on herbaceous plants for my flower beds, and seeing if I can, you know, get hold of some friends like you who might do some dividing for me and plan ahead for that.
Yeah,
so rather than sort of suddenly, you know, turn around in kind of November and think, oh, it's all too late, actually thinking in August, okay, what am I thinking? What I want it to look like? What am I going to sow ahead of time so that, you know, I've got plants in the spring? And also, what am I going to divide? And then maybe what am I going to invest in?
Yeah, well, I think I'd just sit down with you with a pen and paper and some catalogues and look at what you want to grow and then plan it out. I mean, herbaceous plantings, I think they look good in a border and sweeps. So you want five, seven of them, but little sweep. You know, if you've got a 10-metre long border, you get 10 sets of sweeping. You'll have an incredibly beautiful border next spring, but summer, but it's all in the planet. It really is.
Yes. So, you know, that's where I go wrong,
time is such a, it's the most valuable thing we own, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think now you're right. What happens is suddenly it's November and you haven't done it. So I think there's the discipline of going, well, if it's August, and August is a quiet month because everybody tends to be on holiday, the kids are off and they go away or whether I find it quiet. I feel like I've got a bit of room in August. So maybe that's the time to sit in your little office and lock the world out. About it.
Have a think. Get the pen and paper out. Yeah. I'm going away during August, so I'm beginning to worry slightly about irrigation. To be honest, I'm quite happy to leave the garden to its own devices after the season we've had. But I do want to look after the greenhouse, and I'm really wondering about finding some time this weekend, actually, to just before I go to maybe put in some kind of simple irrigation system. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you've got one here. You can buy little kits that are quite cheap. You put them on a timer. You put that into your hose pipe connection on the water tap, and they're quite easy to assemble. You know, they're quite easy. They're not that expensive.
What about homemade?
Well, you can homemade. I mean, there's a bit more technical. So you need something to pump it, basically, so to click it on. So the timer, maybe you could do just buy the timer. And then we used to use things called leaky pipes, which is like recycled rubber with holes punched in. Be more likely to use that in a long border around trees, etc. I think a little home and I bought irrigation kit for the greenhouse is fine. Or if you wanted to save money, I mean, we will do all sorts. On the allotment, I will get a 2-litre water bottle, and I will then get rid of the cap, and I will then put about 7 layers of cling film around the mouthpiece, and then puncture it with a needle, that's a bit excessive, with a sewing needle, and that you fill it up, and then that slowly drains. So you cut the top out of it.
Okay.
That'll slowly drain. I mean, houseplants, they go in the bath.
Yeah.
But puddling as well. Just making sure you bank up the soil maybe 10 centimetres around away from the plant, if you're something like a courgette or a pumpkin, so that when any watering sits in that pole, you're not losing it to transpiration, it's not moving out.
So get out and about, have a look at the plants that actually could do with a bit of vulnerable.
Like a squash, if it gets hot for a few weeks, it will flag, you know. So I like to bank my squashes on piles of soil and then dip the centre so the water collects. The other thing also is give it really, really deep water before you leave, the proper water.
Yeah.
It's better deep watering this time of year than little and often. Little and often, all it means is all the roots come to the surface. Because it's little and often, that means you're there more vulnerable to drying out. Mulchy, another good one.
Yes.
Because that'll help keep the humidity around the plant, the moisture in the plant, and also the humidity on plants like courgettes will keep the powdery mildews away as well.
Yes. Okay. All right. We need to be thinking about mildew. It's the mildew month, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. The other thing that I very often miss is sowing green manures.
Yeah.
And it's a good time of year to do that,
yeah,
isn't it?
August is perfect. Perfect. Starting August. I like mustard. I sow mustard into my gate. I'll be doing that in August, no problem. You know, it's just protecting that soil, keeping that soil conditioned, aerated, stopping leaching of nutrients. It's just a bare, you don't want bare soil. It's just exposed to the elements. So, and it's quite a beautiful plant. The only thing I'd say with green manures is make sure you crop them before they flower, because otherwise they tend to get very pithy. So as they're budding up, it's the best time to dig them in.
Okay. All right. I'll let you know how I get on with that.
Yeah.
It's actually remembering to do it, but that's good that we've talked about it. Maybe I'll actually do it this year. That's really good. You have been doing great things on your balcony.
Oh, right, yeah, I have. I mean, you haven't heard me talk about the balcony much this year because I haven't really been doing it on it because I've had a massive change out there. Due to regulations, the wooden balcony, the wooden decking was deemed not safe.
Obviously, yeah, it's really slippery and things.
And
it's
all rotted as well.
Yeah, it rots, yeah.
It's like
yeah.
I'd be watering it.
Yeah.
So that had to go. It's been a long process. Obviously, I live right at the top, so I'm on this penthouse, so everything has to be lugged up. But now I've got a lovely, lovely metal, grey metal balcony flooring, and it's not. There's no gaps in it like you do with the decking, so it's all bunged up and it's permeable. It looks, I have to say, very, very posh.
Very smart.
It doesn't look a bit posh. So all my pots and hanging baskets are back out there. As we're late in this season, I've just put colour in. I put petunia, pelargoniums. I've got a few tommies out there. So I'll just have a few months. I've got a very posh new chair, which has a special place for my beer.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
And so that's all gone out there. And
it sounds rather understated, Chris.
Seriously, it's because it's so late. So, you know, I just couldn't justify spending a load of money I'll just put basics out there, I'll enjoy a bit of colour.
Yes.
Until the autumn, and then my bulbs will go in there. Yeah.
Well, of course, it's August, we've decided, is the planning month as we sit in our deck chairs.
Yeah.
So, have you got any special plans for the balcony next year?
Well, I have, yeah. Obviously, bulbs will go in at the autumn. I have my usual display of bulbs, but I've got a big plan because I'm itching to get at it through the summer as well, which is when I'm really interactive with it. So I will grow a lot of HSL stuff, Heritage Seed Library, next year. I plan to do a lot of that, and I'll make it all white. So it's going to be a night garden.
I love the sound of that.
A nightclubber's garden for my new sofa and its beer table. That's what's going to happen out there.
Oh.
So Heritage Edibles, white flowers. That's going to be
okay,
white.
So no, next year's not. We're not going to go blousy. We're not going to go.
It's going to be all white.
My word. That is a big change.
I'm going to put an arch in, and I've got my eye on a beautiful white passion flower.
Oh, yes.
So I'll have a bit of that and a bit of sticky sperm. Some scent. My eyes tick, 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 tick.
White passion flower.
Yes, you got. There's lots of varieties. The name doesn't come to my mind straight away, but there's lots of cold bars, and you can get a really nice whitey sort of creamy one.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
So it's going to be the... years ago, I did a series called The Plantsman on BBC Two, and it had a different theme every week, and one was nightclubbers, and it was called that because all the gardens were white.
Okay.
You just get that lovely, you know, it lifts, doesn't it, at night time, at dusk. It really lifts.
Yes, definitely. White.
White's a magnificent silver or silver foliage as well. Lots of issues and stuff like that.
Well, who would have thought that August is the month to have so much to look forward to? But I'm really excited.
I am as well. Yeah. You know, it's good to be a gardener, isn't it?
Now, this month, I chatted with Nick Moll, Policy Manager from the Pesticide Action Network, also known as PAN. Currently, they're working on a petition to ban the use of pesticides in urban areas across the UK. Nick spoke to me about the knock-on effects of pesticide use in communities and what it would take to get the UK to go pesticide-free. So, Nick, first of all, you're running a ban on urban pesticides. Can you just explain to us what you would define as a pesticide and also what's the difference between herbicides and pesticides?
Okay, that's a great question. That's something that comes up very often. So when we're talking about pesticides, we mean all the sides that kill things. So whether that's an insecticide that kills insects, a herbicide that kills plants, fungicide that kills fungi, etc. That's the umbrella term for all of those things. All of those are used to some extent in the non-agricultural sectors in our towns and cities, but for the most part, what councils and others are using are herbicides to kill sort of vegetation, plant materials, etc. That's by far the overwhelming type of pesticide that is used in the urban setting.
Let me also ask you about glyphosate, and so people understand what it is and what it's used for.
Yeah, glyphosate is a herbicide. Most famously, it's the constituent part of the product Roundup, originally made by Monsanto, now owned by Bayer. And herbicides being the most widely used pesticide in the urban setting, you know, by councils, etc. Glyphosate, the active substance, is the most widely used of those by a long shot. It's available all over the place.
Widely been talked about as being perfectly safe.
It's not perfectly safe. There are an awful lot of scientific literature showing that actually it's harmful to human health. There have been a lot of sort of quite high-profile court cases in the US that have linked its use by groundskeepers and the public and others to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There are still, I think, thousands of cases pending in the US about that. It has been linked in the agricultural setting, particularly in places like Argentina, with sort of liver and kidney and reproductive problems where people have been exposed to it over a long time. And again, there's a growing body of research that shows actually it could be harming bees by interfering with their gut biome and impacting how they feed and navigate and that sort of thing. So it's not harmless. It also finds its way into our water supply as it runs off hard surfaces into water. And we have to pay to have that removed in our water bills. So the water companies remove that. And it's also in the food we eat because it's used widely in agriculture as well. So it turns up as residues in food, notably in sort of grains and cereals and arable crops.
How long has the campaign against urban pesticides been running?
We have been running our pesticide-free towns campaign since 2015. Well, it's sort of time to ramp it up now. So we've gone from the bottom up. So we've gone from the grassroots community stuff, working with, I suppose, the middle, you could call it, with councils. Now we want to work from the top down and actually get a national ban put in place to seal the deal, if you like.
I mean, I'm not alone in this, and a lot of people have been saying this year there is just a dearth of insects. It's really terrifying. I've allowed a globe artichoke to flower in my garden over the last couple of years, and I remember last summer or the summer before, I counted 14 bees on one head. Alone. And this year, this weekend even, I went and had a look at them. They're just in flower at the moment. So one bee.
Wow.
I mean, it's really frightening. And the general sense of, you don't even have to sort of cover up food because, you always used to cover up food in the summer, didn't you? Because of flies in the kitchen. Even leaving the windows open at night time, again, something you used to be a bit careful about. This summer, I haven't had any insects come into the house. I don't know, whether that is a phenomenon that you've come across this year.
I have. I've heard a lot of people saying the exact same thing. And actually, we've got a just out the front, there's a lavender bush, which is usually sort of absolutely alive with bees. And yeah, very few indeed. But yeah, it does seem that this year has been particularly bad in terms of insect numbers in general. And I mean, I don't think we can necessarily attribute it directly to the use of pesticides, but I think we've had several years of very strange weather patterns over the summer. This year in particular has been particularly odd. I mean, we do know that insect abundance and diversity is decreasing across the board. So maybe we've, well, I hate to say it, at some point maybe reached a tipping point. I mean, I hope that's not the case, but could this be the sign that we have finally reached a tipping point? 60 years later, we are actually experiencing what Rachel Carson predicted. 60 years ago, she predicted the sort of the silent spring, and we're still actually fighting many of the same battles against the same opposition that she highlighted so eloquently back then. I guess we're going to have to see what happens over the succeeding summers, but it's not a good sign.
You said at PAN that your work is science-based, but I just wonder if there's any or research aspects that are coming through now that are a cause for hope, new solutions that weren't around 30 or 40 years ago.
Oh, that is an interesting question. Much of the science has been focused on the negative aspects, identifying what's been happening and the problems that are happening. I'm not sure so much if it's research. I think it's, because all the knowledge is actually already there. I mean, you'll know from the world of organics that a lot of knowledge is already there. It's, I think there have become better mechanisms for sharing that kind of knowledge. And as I say, there's a greater awareness that we need to do things differently. And that's something that I've certainly seen change over the last 17 years. You know, when I started doing this, the public, you know, almost had no idea what a pesticide was. Now they know at least two, and that's the one that kills bees and the one that's sprayed on our streets, which is mainly glyphosate. So even that level of awareness, perhaps rather than research, there's an understanding of things could be done differently and need to be done differently. And I do find that encouraging.
It's almost that people are now wrestling with it rather than ignoring it. You know, it's like they don't know quite how to take the practical steps, you know, going back to that sense of people feeling, well, I've got to use pesticides, I've got to use herbicides. Actually, they are wrestling with that, you know, it seems now. I mean, I don't think people are generally aware of how much spraying is done in public areas and green spaces. What, in your experience, are the main reasons for using pesticides in parks, for example?
There were two reasons, cost and labour. I mean, there is no getting away from it that, you know, pesticides do what they're advertised to do. They do it efficiently and they do it relatively cost-effectively, particularly when you're looking at sort of the amenity sector. So you're looking at streets and pavements or parks, you know, hard surfaces, playgrounds, that sort of thing. You know, spraying glyphosate, you can get out and do it, and it will work, and you can do it quickly. And there are other factors as well, in that it's legal, and there's the whole, well, we've always done it this way, well, at least since the sort of 1970s, we've always done it this way, so it can't be a problem. And there's also a sort of, I don't know whether it is just a British outlook, but there's this very much this sort of neat and tidy mindset,
yes,
that is prevalent in many areas that we see. So these are all factors. There's, apart from, you know, people like Pan and yourselves and others, there's not people, you know, sort of opposing it. You know, you see adverts for Roundup on TV. The government say, well, it's all fine, it's approved, it's safe. So where are the drivers to change, other than people's realization that actually we shouldn't be doing this? And just to get back to the encouraging side of things, and on our sort of pesticide free towns campaign, which we started, I think, in 2015 or 2016. Very much at the beginning of that, it was about empowering local communities to push their councils for change, and that, you know, that's really what, you know, whether it's setting up petitions or going to council meetings, etc. And in recent years, the last sort of 4 or 5 years, we've had councils coming directly to us without being pushed by their residents to say they want to do things differently. So again, that's encouraging as well.
So in a town setting or a city and a local park, what are the dangers to people using that park? What are the dangers to kids who might want to, you know, roll down a grass hill? What is the main concern here?
Pesticides are poisons. You know, there's no getting away from that fact. That's their thing. They're introduced into the environment to kill living organisms, and whether that's weeds or insects or fungi or whatever, that's their job. They don't limit themselves to sort of tackling the thing that they're aimed at. They can and do have impacts on human health. They can be carcinogenic or endocrine disrupting chemicals or reproductive toxins or neurotoxins or acutely toxic, etc. So we're spraying these around, and people will and can come into contact with them. So yeah, parks are a good example, but also our sort of streets and pavements and hard surfaces and around hospitals, in car parks, etc. They don't just disappear. And it's also worth pointing out, also, the food that we eat has pesticide residues on it in many instances. Not everyone is as susceptible to the potential harm from pesticides. And I don't want to be alarmist about this and say that, you know, you go for a walk in the park, you're going to come away with, you know, X, Y, Z negative health outcome. And the problem is, we don't really know. Again, it's worth saying that there are multiple routes of exposure, and not just to pesticides, but to chemicals in general. You know, we're walking through a daily basis a toxic soup of chemicals that could interact, and we've no idea how they all work together to heighten or make things worse. But one of the most vulnerable groups are children, because of the way their bodies are still developing and the various systems within them that can be impacted by pesticides, and also the way that they play and they work. So, you know, you're not necessarily going to find an adult rolling about in the grass in an area that's just been sprayed, but you may well find a child doing that. You're not necessarily going to be, you know, find adults in a playground, but obviously that's the natural habitat for children. Certainly, well, if we might have started better summer than we're having. So, you know, they're more likely to come into contact with it. And I think the simple answer to your question is we don't actually know what the long-term impact might be. Having said that, you know, and knowing that there are alternatives to pesticides that do work, then as a purely precautionary approach, we shouldn't be using them.
Yeah.
Pesticide use in our towns and cities is completely unnecessary. France has banned the use of all non-agricultural pesticides. That includes the public being able to buy them from garden centres or whatever for use in their gardens. All the cities in France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Denmark, I think actually recently Bulgaria, across the board, are all managed without the use of pesticides, and they're not overrun with out-of-control plants, etc.
I mean, so when you say councils come to you wanting help, what's your advice to them then?
It's quite involved. So it's not, there are some key points that they have to take on board if they're actually going to succeed, that there is no silver bullet. There's no like-for-like replacement. You know, you can't just switch out the use of a herbicide for whatever system it is and expect the same. It's about a shift in mindset. It's about a change of approach completely to doing what you're doing and what you're used to. Also, it takes time. You're not going to be able to do it overnight. And you sort of need a clear plan and a clear policy, which includes an understanding of the area that you're in. You know, things like, you know, changing, I mean, this is not necessarily pesticide related, but changing your mowing regime, you know, doing much less mowing. And I think No Mow May is a really great initiative that many have adopted. Not only does it provide all sorts of things for wildlife, but it saves costs if you're not mowing as often. And again, you sort of mentioned the whole, how do you make it not look unkempt? Well, you can leave, you know, for like a road verge and mow a half meter strip just down the side and leave the rest, and actually, you know, that looks pretty good, and the public think, well, they are doing this is a positive move. It's not just been left. And I've come across, you know, so many instances where sort of a council thought, well, this is great, we're just going to leave this area to go wild, and they leave it to go wild, and then next thing they're inundated with complaints from the public, and so, well, you know, go and put a sign up and say we're doing this for the bees, and they do that, and a couple of weeks later they're getting emails saying, this is amazing, can we have more areas? Yeah. So they're simple sort of steps.
So signage is one of the things that's good. But what do you do about those sort of more intractable elements like weeds coming through pavements?
Yeah, so there's a lot of, again, this, it's not as sort of black and white as that. Not everything that's growing on a pavement is bad. And we produced a free guide on pavement plants. People can look and say, well, actually, you know, we can leave this because it's going to die in a couple of weeks, or we can leave this because it's really good for pollinators. And others, well, we need to get rid of that. So there are other ways of getting and dealing with things. So there are, you know, the obviously sort of old-fashioned ways of hand weeding and pulling and using hoes, which some places do. But I think one of the really key things is prevention, you know, making sure that there's not in the areas where you don't want plants, making sure there's not an area where they can grow in the first place. So making sure the guttering, you know, the gutters are clear of detritus, which would be habitat for those, or the back line is clear. So sweeping and brushing will also remove any weed growth that's there, but it'll also make sure that there's no habitat for it to re-establish. And one of the things that you see with sort of herbicide use is you'll go and you'll spray off the plants and they'll all die, and then they'll decompose and they'll turn into a lovely habitat for the next wave of plants. So you're not actually addressing the problem, you're just sort of sticking a plaster over it, if you like. So yeah, prevention is great. Sweeping and brushing and getting out, understanding what should be removed and what shouldn't or doesn't need to be removed, again, that's key.
How much is the, you know, more famous U-turns of councils saying, okay, we are going to go pesticide free, oh no, we can't, we just can't make it work? And there's been a few sort of high profile ones of those. How does that affect things?
Well, again, this is why we would like to see legislation in place, because that would then support councils to be able to stick to the course. And there are, and I think you may be referring to Brighton in particular here.
Yeah, sure.
It's not as simple as it didn't work. It's because I didn't have a plan in place. And, you know, people get quite excited and they want to do this and they want to do it now. Well, they just stopped spraying. They didn't have any notion of, well, how are we going to reach here? You know, it's like they stopped overnight without any kind of thought about how they're going to achieve this. Then they got hit by COVID, the lockdowns. So they were going to try and recruit people. They couldn't recruit people. They couldn't get out and do things. And then when lockdowns lifted, everybody was obviously couldn't go abroad. So they flocked down to Brighton. And then, of course, all their resources had to be focused on managing the seafront, which was, you know, covered in litter and rubbish from day trippers on a daily basis. So they had to focus it all on. So it was a lack of planning and that sort of that storm.
Really interesting, isn't it? Because you hear the phrase integrated pest management, and actually there's almost this kind of integrated approach needs to be, you know, it's the same. It is still integrated pest management, isn't it? It's just without the use of pesticides.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. And I don't know whether this is a problem with our politics in general or just in certain areas. And I make this point actually to many councils. Almost never does a council get somebody writing to them to say, well done. They get people writing to complain, and it's often the same few people who write to complain. However, that's taken on board by, you know, I think local councillors, wherever they are, you know, they're operating in terms of votes on very small margins. So they tend to listen to those people that are making the biggest noise, and that's often picked up in the media as well. I mean, there were some absolutely ridiculous press articles about Brighton and what was going on in Brighton, in the national media as well, which were not helpful. So there is that as well. But councils need to be able to... I tried my local council because they were out hand-weeding. I thought, oh, great, I'll send an email and congratulate them. There wasn't anywhere, any channel to do that. All the channels were for complaints. So I actually had to put a complaint in and say, this isn't a complaint. Fantastic. So, you know, open a way for people to congratulate you and use that as a you know, justification for what you're doing. But we have got, actually, on our website, we've got a really good article written by my colleague, sort of a myth buster about what happened in Brighton. And I would urge people to read that before thinking, well, this has just failed. And again, I'd also point to Europe. You know, they're doing it. And they have government support for it, and they have legislation in place, and it works. It is often hard. You know, councils are facing all sorts of difficulties, you know, financial and, you know, staffing and that sort of thing. So they do need that support, I think, from our legislators.
So Garden Organic and Pan have been friends for a long time. Nick, you work for the Pesticides Action Network, an international organisation. You must have a huge amount of research and information available to the public. How do we do a bit of a deep dive into that?
The best way to find out more about pesticides and the work we're doing is to have a look at our website, www.pan-uk.org. And there you can go and have a look at either the work we're doing or some of the key issues. We've got all sorts of research available for people to look at. We've got a blog that we publish regularly. And it's a wealth of material from what you can do in your own garden. It's probably not as extensive as Garden Organics material, but things on, you know, gardening without pesticides. Have a look at we've got a really great guide to pavement plants. So, you know, if your council stops spraying, you know, what you might start see popping up around you. And that's lots of really lovely illustrations in there. But also our work with cotton growers, so helping cotton growers in Africa to switch from, you know, sort of conventional cotton growing to organic, you know, the work we're doing there. There's a wealth of information coming up. We do quite a lot of work with the biggest retailers. We run they're doing on pesticide issues. We've got another one that will be published later this year, but you can read all sort of the background on that. And we publish every year I think called the Dirty Dozen, which looks at pesticide residues in our food. And everything on our website is free for people to use and download. Have a look.
So, Chris, that was a really interesting interview for me to do, and just to stop and, you know, process the many, many years that Nick and that organisation PAN UK have put into campaigning against the use of pesticides. Obviously, it's really dear to our heart here at Garden Organic. I mean, one of the things that we talked about was around parks and you know, urban green spaces and the use of pesticides in those. I do think that people just don't realise, you know, that that's being used. I mean, in your experience, when you started working in the parks, was there a prolific use of chemicals?
Well, you know what, on a day-to-day basis, no. No, you know, we used them, but I don't have any big recall of them. It was all of marching around in big suits with packed CP3s.
Yeah, masks on. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, and we did do that, but yeah. it was fairly intermittent, I think. I think you see a bit more of it now. Do you know why? There's no trained gardeners, there's less of them. And they do it as emergency treatment rather than keeping on top. So there's that. I mean, I saw some horrendous stuff. We didn't do a lot of chemicals. It wasn't a daily thing, but when we did, it was pretty horrendous. Like, I remember we used to put nicotine shreds in the greenhouse. And so what you do is you set light to them on the paths, and then it smokes the whole greenhouse. So it just kills anything inside. So like cockroaches would be falling out of the plants. We'd be walking around in there 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
We'd literally be walking around in 10 minutes later. We used to do this Casson G, it was called, I think, and it was a soil sterilant. So it was a granulate. You put it in the soil, and then you'd cover the soil with plastic, and it would just gas anything in the soil. The
idea was
to stop the wood. So there was some pretty horrendous stuff going on. But I think it wasn't a daily thing. And I think gradually there was an awareness. We were never about upsetting the ecosystem, but I remember there also being issues, and there were issues now with safety. If the bath is full of weeds and you're 8 years old, and you know, so there's a litigation issue to it.
Yeah, of course.
That wasn't there before.
Yeah.
I'll be very, very interested to see what places like. There's two cities come to mind, Tokyo and Paris, both banned pesticides, didn't
yeah.
they? So it'd be very interesting to study them after a couple of years of how they're stopping that issue of litigation of people maybe being. I hear it everywhere I go. If I go to an In Bloom conference or something like that, people I immediately gardeners I deal a lot with, their biggest complaint is, there's too much weed on the pavements. It's one of the biggest things that comes up now.
Yeah. And what advice do you give when those things do come up? I mean, you know, in terms of managing things as organically as possible.
Well, certainly make sure the stuff's pointed. Like, obviously, if you've got a path, you know, and one of the problems you've got is, like a lot of old pathways, you know, around by me, all the paths have cracked and moved up, and then the weeds, that's what they do, they're colonisers, they get in and they inhabit that. So you could definitely point them properly, you know, make sure there's not those gaps here. That's one solution. As far as borders and stuff go, make sure you've got tiering, make sure you can't see any soil, block out the weeds through lack of light, so you make sure the plants you want to grow are out competing them.
Mm.
So I hate seeing border with big gaps in it.
Yes.
That's just going to fill with weeds, basically, isn't it? It's a bit. There's a place near me, it's a well-known building merchants, and they have a big fence around it, which they don't maintain, and it's full of wildflowers. But they're not on the path, so I like to see them.
Mm.
So this is kind of also an attitude thing, isn't it?
That,
like Paolo described it, you don't have to go around gassing everything. You know, if you've got weeds in the middle of the path, they're dangerous, get a shovel to take them out, scrape them off.
Mm.
But you can't look at them. We have to make sure everything's cleansed all the time. And all those plants around that building merchants are incredibly important pollinators. They're always full of bees and hoverflies. And so, you know, this is the point, is that it's about sharing our world, really.
It is. And, you know, one last question, because we do often refer to your time at Westminster Abbey and the fact that you turned it organic.
Yeah.
Any insights from that you can quickly share?
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, I mentioned it once, the pointing. I made sure everything, like, we have these very old flags, Yorkstone flags, and so I would make sure they were repointed once a year. That's pretty much. I'm also full borders. If I did see weeds in there, we'd weed them out, basically. That's what we do, the old boiling water trick. If there was just one here and there, you know, if you boil about a cup of tea, you go out onto the path, you see a dandelion, you get rid of it that way. So, yeah, I mean, mostly, if you keep on top of it, it's not a problem. If you've got pathways that are already clear, and obviously you've got a lot of tourists coming through there, you don't want to slip and break their hip. So you make sure it's clear. But once you're on top of it, it was not a problem.
So would you personally support a ban on urban pesticides?
Well, I certainly would. There'd be a lot of immediate horticulturists might be screaming at the radio now, or because they go, well, you know, we've got to be able to keep things in order and stuff. But I think there's other ways around it.
Yeah.
I think that it's already been shown in cities like Tokyo and Paris that it can be done. There are other methods to doing it. We just need to have a strategy. We need to think it through, as PAN do, as they campaign, as they do, to make sure we put in place a system that makes it obsolete.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll be sharing details on how people can get involved with the ban on urban pesticides at the end of this episode. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Time now for some of your questions for us to answer. So I'm here with Anton and Chris. So first question is courgettes. Do you have any idea why my courgettes are producing only male flowers? One's in a pot, the other is in a bed. No sign of a female flower on either. Anton, where can we go with this? Just tell us a little bit about the whole male and female flower thing with courgettes.
So courgettes are one of the plants that has both male and female flowers on the same plant. Once you get your eye in, it's actually really easy to tell the difference between them. So the male flowers have got the flowers on a long stalk, and the female flowers, you tend to see a sort of swollen fruit actually just beneath the flower. So even from a distance, you can actually see quite easily whether they're male or female flowers. If you want to look inside them, the male flowers, the anthers on a courgette, they're actually sort of fused into one structure. So it looks a little bit like a sort of small yellow banana inside. So, you might be sort of expecting to see lots of anthers separate with pollen on them on a male flower and a courgette, but actually they're all fused into one.
Okay. And you have to have male and female flowers at the same time for courgettes to be produced? Or
yeah, you will do, because obviously it's the mostly bees, but also other insects like flies and stuff as well will carry the pollen between them. It does help to have more than one plant as well, and they can sort of pollinate themselves, but it's better if it comes from a different plant.
Oh, okay. So ideally you don't want to be picking the flowers until the fruit has started to set?
I mean, it's a continued process. So I mean, if you wanted to pick the odd flower for cooking with or to look nice in your salads, you could still do that, but don't sort of continuously keep pulling all the flowers off, otherwise you won't end up with any courgettes.
Okay, all right, top tip. So Chris, this time of year, how are your courgettes doing?
Well, I think a similar thing. Actually, I'm going to widen it out just slightly because of the cooler, sort of damper weather we've had this year. A lot of my plant, runner beans I can think of and stuff like that, isn't producing a lot of flower. It seems to put a lot of foliage on. I don't know if Anton's had this experience, but things like runner beans have got big old green leaves. I've got a polytunnel I look after that's got French runner climbing beans and big old leaves, a lot of tomato in there, but not a massive amount of flower. And I wonder whether, because of the cooler conditions, a lot of foliage has been put on and not as much flower, and this may be causing this problem here. Now, I think that these plants will catch up with that. They'll sort that out. We need some warm weather for our own benefits as well as the plants. So I think it will catch up. I think you can maybe give a potassium feed. So you might want to use our Bocking 40, because it's got a nice high potassium content in it. Liquid feed that on, or pellet that on, just to try and encourage the flowering. But certainly it's temperature related, but I'm not going to get too stressed about it. I have every faith in my courgettes, and I think some warm weather will buck them on. I really do. I planted mine quite late as well, so they're not that far ahead anyway. I would say, if you have got excess male flowers, they do make excellent tempura.
Yeah, delicious. I must say, I hadn't realised that it only produces a male flower first, the plant. And so actually, the other thing to do is wait and see. So if you've only got male flowers, well, the female ones are coming along next.
Yeah, they'll be along in a minute. Yeah. See, the women are wiser. They wait around until the conditions are right.
Exactly. Absolutely. All right. On to carrots now. I normally have a really good crop of carrots, but this year's been completely hopeless. I had no germination for my first sowing. So I sowed another lot earlier in the year, and I've had about 2 carrots appear. I've used seed from different packets, so I don't think that can be the issue. What have I done wrong? Well, Anton, what have they done wrong?
So I always think with carrots and parsnips as well, so getting the germination is actually the most difficult bit. Once you've got that cracked, they do tend to look after themselves pretty well. So carrot seeds take quite a long time to germinate. They take about 2 or 3 weeks, but I just think this really sort of cold spring, which has extended into a cold summer as well, has just made that period even longer. And during that period, those sort of germinating seeds are just really vulnerable to any sort of mishap. They're particularly vulnerable to the soil getting dry at any point during that sort of stage when they're still germinating. So sometimes you think you've sort of watered the surface of the soil, but actually when you sort of scrape around, it's actually quite dry underneath. It's just the very surface that you've watered. So that can be quite tricky. One trick that I've found works quite well if you do need to water them is to just sort of build a very small little bund either side of your drill of the carrots so that the soil is slightly raised up, and then that tends to sort of pull the water just above where the carrots are germinating, and then that water will soak into the soil a lot better than if you just have the soil completely flat where the water will just spread over the whole surface.
Okay, so like a sort of little mini dam or a little wall up to the edge of your drill.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it only takes a few minutes to you can even just do it with your hands. You don't need anything elaborate.
Yeah, but just directing the water down to the seed. Okay, they're thirsty plants then, or thirsty seeds. Chris, how have you done with carrots?
Yeah, I've had similar problems, to be honest with you. Certainly patchy germination. I think that's definitely an irrigation thing to a certain degree, because I'm not on the allotment every day. I travel a lot with work, and I think keeping that consistency has affected it. But I've also had a lot of problem with mollusks, the S word again.
Yes.
And slugs and snails, I think they've been definitely attacking. All drill sowing, all seed sowing this year I found tricky, because they're just so vulnerable at that stage. And then when you get all this wet weather, they've been out in force. So that's definitely been a problem. Do not despair, as always. We're always a half glass full operation,
yes, absolutely,
as you know. And
yes.
So I've re-sowed mine. This time I've done it two ways. The first one was a bit out of desperation, as I sowed them in modules, which you'd never normally do because they don't like being moved. But that actually works because they filled the modules out quite well. But I've got a lot of top growth and not a lot of carrot.
Yes.
But what I've done now is I've sowed them, and I do this with parsnips every year, as I collect toilet rolls. There's an ample supply of them in all households. And I sow them into there. And then I'll just take that. Once I get the germination, it seems to be a lot more successful in that more controlled environment. I'll just put them on the balcony in my little greenhouse on there and do it there. And then I'll just plant them straight into the ground. And because the toilet rolls are biodegradable, I don't have to touch the roots. I don't interfere with the roots. So they'll go straight into the ground, and hopefully I'll have a bit more luck. Hopefully it'll be drier and there won't be so many mollusks on the march.
Yes. I mean, do you do one per toilet roll or a little?
I'd like to sow two. I was taught every kind of sowing. I think a lot of gardeners maybe, especially ones that worked on parts, I always put two seeds to a module. I do with runner beans, to be honest with you. I just think I was taught that. Whether it's necessary, I don't know. But that little bit of competition at germination, I think it's quite encouraging as you get stronger seedling. So I'll do that. And also the other thing is, I mean, I get a lot of root fly on my allotment. The other thing you can do is you can plant them in tubs.
Yes.
Have them in tubs, a little globular carrot, you can get ready in 6 to 8 weeks. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's expensive because you're obviously laying out on compost and stuff like that. But, you know, a fresh carrot out of the ground is no comparison to a supermarket carrot.
No, and if you've raised it up out of, you know, out of the ground and into a pot, it does mean you're not going to then be dealing with root fly, and also potentially a bit easier to control the slugs.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I think especially at this point in the year when we're all looking for a bit of success, still worth having a go.
I don't think any point, you know, carrots are quick turnaround if you look after them properly, so you can get ones that are quite fast producing. So, no, you've got, I mean, we're only in, you know, coming into August. I reckon we'll have a late summer. I reckon you've got till sort of mid-October to get crops still coming out. So go for it, I say. And as we've said, we always say, you know, I'd rather be out gardening than watching telly, or, and it saves me money because I'm not in the pub.
Yes, indeed. all right, well, keep gardening is the message here. Now, last month we had a question about strawberries being picked and put in piles, and the general consensus was that this was being done by birds, specifically crows, actually, I think we decided. However, we've been contacted by a couple of listeners who beg to differ. So firstly, Lucy emailed in to say, this is definitely the work of voles, or perhaps other rodents. When I lived in a town with lots of cats around, it wasn't a problem. But now I'm living the good life in the country, I'm finding out what a menace they can be. I don't have cats for the sake of the blue tits that keep the aphids under control, but rodents are the price I pay. Well, we're quite fond of voles here, Anton, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that you're doing a service to a sort of cute furry friend. So, yeah, I have had rodents do those sort of tricks as well. They particularly seem to do it with beans as well. Broad beans, I've seen them piled up as well. And yeah, I mean, who thinks about it that voles just want to have fun, don't
they? I don't know, I had so organised. I'll just leave this pile of fruit here, but I'll stack it first.
I wonder if they come back for it. I mean, it is a wonderful kind of notion, isn't it?
It is, I really like it. I'm almost like feeling out myself, actually.
Yes. It's like you've created your larder, now yeah. You can come back for it. Okay, so Heather emailed with a similar response. I've just listened to the July podcast and the question about strawberries nipped off and left in piles was asked. I have that problem, but it's definitely not the birds as they're covered securely with fleece. Not all the fruit have been picked and it did include the green ones. I thought it might be mice. What do you think, Chris, on this?
I feel sorry for the crows that we blamed completely.
Yeah, sorry about that. Okay, slanderous.
I know, we'll be sued by crows if we're not careful. Well, it sounds, it could be well rodents, it could. I mean, yeah. Without seeing it in operation, it's very difficult. But if they're going under the fleece, then maybe it is. I mean, mice will, you know, they've got good appetites, haven't they? I didn't ever find them stashing stuff somewhere, but maybe if there's an abundance of food, that'll be the case. That could well possibly be right. I think if you're having big problems with this, I mean, mice will chew through things anyway, so I don't think netting or anything like that's really going to help you. I think maybe try and grow them in a different substrate, in a different environment. So in schools we put them in drain pipes, upright drain pipes. You just drill a little hole in all the way up, block the bottom off, and then you can plant straight into that, which is great because nothing's getting out in there, not the slugs either, so they can grow in that. All as I do on my balcony, I put them in hanging baskets, so you wouldn't get a massive crop that way. But I like strawberries grown organic grown, because you only get that one, two crops a year, but they are just so wonderful.
Wonderful.
They're just so... But yeah, so try maybe if you're really struggling, if the mice are being that organised and stuck in pantries, then try a hanging basket.
Thanks, Anton. Thanks, Chris. That's all we've got time for this month. I hope you found the interview with Nick Mole informative. What you may not know is that Garden Organic was a founder member of the Pesticide Collaboration, and together with many other like-minded organisations, we're campaigning to end the use of toxic chemicals across parks, streets and playgrounds in our towns, villages and cities. You can learn more about the campaign on our website at gardenorganic.org.uk. If you want to support our campaigning work and research, why not become a member? You'll also get loads of information and resources to help you succeed as an organic gardener. Thanks again to our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition, and to Kevin McLeod for the music. We'll see you next time.